If you have your Bibles, you can go ahead and turn to Hebrews chapter 11, the famous Hall of Faith chapter in Hebrews chapter 11. I know this is everybody's favorite Advent passage. Is that right? You guys been reading this in Advent already? I'm kind of kidding about that a little tiny bit, but Hebrews actually, I think, is very, very relevant during Advent season. The entire Advent season is about finding hope in the waiting, is it not? It's all about hope and the waiting. It's a season that's dedicated to looking back and remembering everything that was brought in with the birth of Jesus, everything, every bit of freedom that he brings in, every bit of grace and intimacy with the Father that he brings into the new covenant. And we take this season to remember everything that was done in his first coming, and we wait with anticipation, recognizing that he has promised to return again, and to make when he does, he's going to make all things new. This is the thing that the Apostle Paul talks about. This is going to be one day when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God our Father. This is the day that Revelation talks about, this day that is coming when there will be no more weeping, no more tears, no more crying, no more pain, because the old things will have passed away and Christ and his perfect rule and reign will come in and make all things brand new. And so this Advent season is all about finding hope and finding faith in the middle of this waiting, remembering what he has accomplished in his first coming, remembering what he still has left to do in his return and in this second coming. And so in this Advent season, we are remembering that all is not yet as it should be. And so this Christmas season, when crazy Uncle Eddie comes to your home and he brings all the family baggage and all the family drama and everything, or maybe it's your brother or sister or your parents or heaven forbid, maybe it's even you, but we're kind of coming in and you're remembering that all is not as it should be yet. And when you're entering into this Advent season and something about the holidays just makes you remember the pain of loss, the pain of something that's been experienced in years past, you're remembering that all is not as it should be yet. This is not all that there is. And that's what we're doing in this Advent season. It is hope in the waiting. It is finding faith in the middle of this waiting period from when Christ first came and when he promises to return. Which is why the book of Hebrews couldn't be more relevant. The book of Hebrews, every step along the way, is a message to the first century church saying, press on in the faith, because in every possible way, Jesus is better. You need to continue on. You need to press on in the faith, because in every possible way, Jesus is better. And of course, in chapter 11, what we're going to see today, the entire chapter is dedicated to faith. I mean, 40 verses of just constant faith. Faith, faith, faith. Here's what it looks like. Here's what it is. Here's what it's described by and things like that. It's just constant faith. And he's going to say, without faith, it's actually impossible to please God. Now, for some of you, that's not that big of a deal, because faith is something that comes somewhat easy for you, right? I mean, if you're watching, some of you were watching the Cowboys game on Thursday, and you're going, oh my gosh, they're 10-1. Proof that God exists, right? I mean, you're kind of going, I've been a fan for 20-plus years, and I've been watching this thing and waiting, and this is all the proof that I need. God exists, and evidently he's a Cowboys fan, right? I mean, Jerry found Dak in the fourth round. That doesn't happen unless God exists, right? Cane Rosso, I swear, I need an endorsement from them, because I feel like I tell you about them all the time. Their Nutella pizza, it is proof that God exists and proof that God loves you, right? Just mascarpone cheese and this Nutella baked on this perfect crust, and it is the greatest thing you'll ever eat in your entire life. Proof that God exists. Of course, having a dairy and gluten allergy is proof that there's an enemy too, so that doesn't really help a whole lot. But right, but for a lot of us, I mean, faith is something that's kind of simple. You look around and you're going, oh yeah, I have no problem. I believe in God. That's not that big of a deal. But walking by faith is something entirely different, isn't it? Like, why would I walk by faith if I didn't have to? Like, why would I walk by faith if my intelligence is taking me pretty far and if I don't really need to? Why would I walk by faith? Isn't it even better to walk by intelligence and things that I can see and things that I can know? Why would I walk by faith? I mean, think about that for a second. If you and I don't know something, if you and I have a question about something, I can Google it and find a million experts and stuff that have the answers to it right then and there. If you and I get sick or have need of medicine or anything like that, there are medicines for everything that are out there, right? Our first response doesn't have to be prayer in a lot of cases and stuff. The first response a lot of times is, well, there's a medicine for it. I mean, we have cures for cancer today. People are living 20, 30 years with HIV today. I mean, it's amazing the things that we've accomplished through medicines that are going on today. If you and I get bored, I mean, you can literally watch a movie on your phone. Right? I mean, this is like Jetsons kind of stuff. I mean, you can watch a movie, you can be like face to face with a relative halfway around the world. That's the kind of thing that we have going on here. There's self-lacing shoes today. Did you guys see this? Nike has self-lacing shoes. I mean, who thought of that? Like, who's going, you know what, I really don't have the time to tie my shoes, and so I need a machine that's going to do it for me. Like literally, we can do that. Hoverboards, they're for real. Like, they actually exist here right now. It's not just the movie Back to the Future or anything like that. It's incredible the things that we've been able to do, and yet Hebrews is going to come on the scene, and he's going to show us that without faith, it is impossible to please God, and beyond that, he's going to show us that that none of these things could even begin to touch the life who invites the power of God into your life through faith. And the entire chapter, 40 verses, is going to be all about walk by faith, walk by faith, walk by faith. No matter how good you have it now, no matter how smart you become right now, there's a power that comes and gets initiated in your life when you're able to walk by faith. And so I want to jump into it this morning, and the hope that I have for us as we go through chapter 11 is very, very simple. It's very simply this, that God would do a work in you and me where he would very much just stretch our faith. That what you walked into this room with this morning, that you're coming in here, and that as God begins to work in you and begins to move in you, that you become more and more aware of the different times and the moments that he may be leading you and stretching you, and that you may be able to say yes to those opportunities more and more, and that you may understand what it is to live by faith. So let's go ahead and jump into it. We're going to start here in chapter 11, verse 1. I love how he gets straight to the point. He did this a few chapters ago, but he kind of bottom lines it for us, and he begins with a definition here in verse 1. Then he's going to get into a lot of stories of what faith actually looks like, and then we're going to talk about a little bit about where that faith comes from towards the end here. But let's pick it up in verse 1. Here's what he says. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the men of old gained approval. So right off the bat, kind of like he did a few chapters ago, remember when he kind of came on, he goes, okay, my main point is this. And he's just very clear, and he just kind of gets off right at the very beginning, defines the whole thing for us, and he says, okay, faith at its most basic element is two things. Okay, faith is assurance and conviction about things that are unseen, two kind of synonymous things, but faith is very simply that. It's the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things that are unseen. In other words, it's not quite as simple as kind of looking and saying, okay, the Cowboys are 10-1, so God must absolutely exist, right? It's a little bit more complex and a little bit more meaty. There's actually a conviction behind it. It's not just a probability. It's not just a, hey, I'm pretty sure about this thing. It means that there's an assurance and there's a conviction about things that are unseen that are going on. Webster's going to define faith like this. He's going to say, faith is complete confidence in someone or something. Okay? So that's good news, because faith that we're talking about here biblically is not just a blind faith. It's not just this random faith, kind of like saying, okay, I believe in this magical unicorn that can do all these different kinds of things. This is a faith that has an object of that faith. It is complete confidence in someone or something. And so we look at the evidence surrounding the things of God, these unseen things, and we decide whether or not we're going to be going all in on this thing. Based on what we know, you're all in, even though there's still mystery about what's at the other end of this thing. It's kind of like when you're playing poker and you've got a straight flush, allegedly, and you've got a straight flush and you decide to go all in on the game, right? You're betting on that, you're going fully all in on this straight flush, even though there's still mystery on the other end of this thing, right? And for some of you, this is the kind of faith that comes really, really easy. But for others, faith is something that's really, really difficult. I'll never forget, years ago, I was talking with a guy, and we were talking about spiritual matters, and he goes, bro, I'm just out on faith altogether. I'm a person of science, right? I'm a person of science. I live my life based on what I can know. Anybody heard anything somewhat similar to this, or know anybody that's kind of like that, or even dealt with those kind of things in your own mind before? You're like, this is our tradition, by the way. You know that, right? This is our Bible church tradition. This is what I've grown up in and loved for our entire life. Like, I'm a logical, linear person. We love the books. We love going and getting advanced education in a lot of ways. We like doing and living by things that we know. All right? I don't like to take a whole lot of risks unless I know what's coming in the future. I love walking by the things that I can see and by the things that I can know beyond a shadow of a doubt. This is our tradition, right? And so a lot of us will sit there and say, okay, I like living by the things that I know. I'm a person of science. I'm a person of what I can see and what I can know. But of course, the problem is that every single one of us have to walk by faith. We do it every single day. Love, relationships, marriage. It is an act of faith, is it not? We live by faith every single day. When I got married, I knew Kat. We dated for about a year. We were engaged for 9 months, which is way too long, by the way. But I dated for a year, 9-month engagement. I knew her pretty well. At the end of the day, when we stood on that stage and we said, I do, it is an act of faith because I have no idea what our future is going to hold. I don't know if we're going to be able to. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know if she's actually going to really love me for the rest of our days. Like, what if things go sour? We don't know these things. It is always an act of faith. I love how Rick Warren described this, but he says that everybody lives by faith. Here's what he says. He says, everyone lives by faith. We do not get to see the other side of death and then choose to believe. So at the end of the day, we're all betting our lives on something. Some bet on Allah. Some bet on Hinduism. Some bet that there's nothing and that we're all here by random chance. Some are betting on their own works and intelligence. I have bet my entire life on Jesus, his life, his substitutionary death, and his resurrection. So when it comes to Jesus, I'm all in. In other words, faith is a given. It is a thing that every human being, whether you believe in God or not, it is a thing that we all have to live by. It is a thing that we all have to walk by. And what Hebrews is saying is that with Jesus, you're actually holding a royal flush in your hand. So why would you not be all in on that kind of a hand? Press on in the faith because in every possible way, Jesus is better. That is faith. It's the assurance of things hoped for. It is a conviction about things that are unseen. Now he's going to continue and he's going to go on from here to describe and really give us example after example of what this whole thing looks like. And it's really important that we get these examples. So let's pick it up here in verse 3 so we can know what we're talking about here. Here's what he says in verse 3 all the way through 11. By faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Verse 7, by faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence, he prepared an ark for the salvation of his household by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Are you seeing a theme here? By faith, verse 8, Abraham, when he was called, he obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and when he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, for he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promise. Are you picking up on the theme that's going on from verse 3 to 11? Everywhere we look, faith is moving. Right? Faith is a response to the conviction of the things unseen that you're holding in this time. It is always moving. By faith, Abel gave. Enoch walked. Noah built. Abraham went. Sarah believed. A little bit later on in this text, we're going to see Jacob blessed. Joseph instructed. Moses chose. Joshua lowered himself and still continued to fight. That is what faith looks like. What we're seeing here is a description, really, of James chapter 2 kind of faith. Remember James chapter 2. James says this. He says, you say that you have faith. I have works. You show me your faith apart from works, and I'm going to show you my faith by my works. That's the kind of faith that we're talking about here. Probably one of the greatest examples I can think of here is the act of rappelling. Have you guys ever been rappelling, rock climbing, or anything like that before? You've done this. Has anybody? We've got a few of these, right? Okay, yeah. High school, probably the first time I ever had a chance to do this. And you guys know this. Well, the first time you ever go rappelling, probably one of the most terrifying things you can do, right? Especially if you do it young, you haven't experienced a whole lot, and you're kind of like, oh my gosh. We were there at Enchanted Rock my sophomore year in high school, big youth group function. We're out there going camping and stuff like that, and we climb up to the top of Enchanted Rock, and of course, you get to the top of Enchanted Rock, and you're like, oh my gosh, we're out here in Austin, and I can actually see my house from here. This is a little terrifying thing, right? And of course, you get all tied up. You've got your harness in, and you got your ropes, and of course, you look over the side of the cliff, and you're like, okay, there are a million different ways I can die today, right? There are a million different things down there that can do damage to my life. I don't know about doing this, right? But eventually, if you're going to repel, you've got to get to the edge of that cliff, and you've got to step back, and you've got to trust in those ropes, and you've got to trust in your instructor. And of course, as you get to the edge of the cliff, what you're going to realize is you cannot be half-hearted in your faith in that time. If you kind of try to creep down and just have partial trust or partial faith in that time, what's going to happen? You're going to jump over the side of the cliff, and you're going to come right back in, and you're going to just crash into the side of the cliff. You've got to lean all the way back so that you're parallel or perpendicular to the side of the rock, and you got to jump, and you got to jump, and you got to jump, and you got to catch yourself with your feet against the rock. And of course, the interesting thing about rappelling down the side of a mountain is that after the first time that you do it, the second time becomes a little bit easier. Like, I'll never forget, after I got done with it, I was terrified the first time, but after that, I got done with it and got to the bottom, I immediately ran back up to do it again. And the third time, I ran back up, and I was like, oh my gosh, let me teach you guys how to then do this. Right? It's one of the most fun things you could possibly do, but the more you do it, the more you become confident in doing it, and you realize, hey, this harness and these ropes, that instructor at the top, he's actually going to catch me. He actually knows what he's doing. Now, here's the question. Who's the person who's got faith here? Is the person who's got faith, is that the kid that's sitting at the top of this rock that's going, okay, yeah, I believe in the ropes, and I believe in the instructor, and I believe everything's going to be safe. In fact, I can tell you all about these ropes. I can tell you all about how they were designed and how they were made. I know the strength of them. I know the weight that it can hold. I actually know what the Greek word for rope is. All right, I know all about that and stuff, and I can tell you all about it. Or is it the person who comes to the edge and actually decides to jump? Church, this chapter is filled with people who got to the edge and decided to jump. All right, look at Abel in verse 4. It says, Abel absolutely jumped. I mean, Abel, you guys remember the story back in Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel, the first brothers we find here in Scripture, comes time that they need to worship the Lord, and it comes time to give him an offering. And of course, it says that Abel comes and he brings his first and his best to the Lord, while Cain comes and he brings his leftovers. Right? Cain comes and he brings leftovers, and Abel, who is a shepherd at that time, or someone who raises livestock, he comes and he brings his first of his lambs, and he brings his best. It's not affordable. It's not a thing that makes a whole lot of sense, but he's giving his first and his best to the Lord. In other words, what we're seeing is, church, by faith, we are to be a people that give our first and give our best. That means that when we are looking at our budget starts with what we are giving first and foremost to the Lord. We don't look at our budget and we don't sit there and say, okay, well, here's my mortgage, here's my food, here's my insurance, here's my car payment, here's my entertainment, here's my cable bill, here's my phone bill, here's all these other kinds of things. Okay, what else do I have left over to give to the Lord? What it means is when we come to the Lord and we are budgeting, we're saying, okay, here is everything I'm giving to the Lord out of generosity, and everything else is going to fall in line. What else do I have to deal with on a month-to-month basis? It's the exact same thing when you're budgeting time and budgeting how you're going to spend your time with the Lord. When I'm thinking about these kinds of things, it's not, okay, I'm going to go to my work, and then I've got my family, I've got my friends, I'm going to go to the bar afterwards, or I'm going to go hang out with the girls, or I'm going to go do this, that, and the other, or I've got my hobbies here on the weekend, and then, wow, you know what, I have no time to spend with the Lord. I mean, where did it all go? I've got my shows on Netflix and everything, I've got my social media and everything going on, I have no time for him. Right? We start budgeting our time with the Lord. We give our first and we give our best to him. That's what it means to walk by faith. Abel is a person at the very, very beginning. He jumped. It makes no sense to give up what little he had, all of it over to the Lord, but Abel is a person that walked by faith, and so he jumped. Noah is the exact same thing. Noah in verse 7 is a person that jumped. I love his story. Do you guys ever pay attention to Noah's story? We ever get past the fact that he had an awesome zoo on a boat, and this is a thing that we're kind of like, we tell the children stories about this story. It's actually a horrific story. His story, it blows my mind every single time I read it. Like, you realize that the flood came about because Noah and his family were the only people on earth that were faithful to the Lord. Think about that for a second. Noah and his family were the last people on the planet who were being faithful to the Lord. Can you imagine the amount of pressure, the amount of temptation, how isolated and alone you must feel in that place? Yet they were still remaining faithful to the Lord. They kept walking by faith. And on top of that, God, in the middle of this time, in the middle of isolation, in the middle of whatever that looks like to be the only person following the Lord in a world that does not, In the middle of that place, God comes to him and says, okay, I'm going to need you to spend the next 100 years of your life, about the next 1/6 of your life, building a boat for a flood that the world has never, ever seen. Yet that's exactly what Noah does. He knows who his God is, and he decides he's walking by faith, whether it's absurd or not, whether it makes sense or not, whether I'm the last person on the planet who is going to be faithful unto the Lord, none of that matters because I'm going to be walking by faith. His story makes no sense, but Noah is a person who jumped. And what that means is that that if everyone in the world is denying God, it means that I am going to remain faithful to him, does it not? If God asks you to do the absolute absurd, it means that I'm going to be faithful to him and I'm going to continue walking with him. It doesn't matter what's going on. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it might feel. If God is calling and God is speaking and God is leading us in a particular way, I am all in with him, regardless of how absurd it may feel. High schoolers, can I just speak with you for a second? Church, this is exactly where some of you guys are. Honestly, you've been walking the top of this fence, and at some point in time, you've got a decision to make if you were going to detract from, separate from your parents' faith that you've inherited for so long, and if the thing is ever going to become personal to you. Like, apart from what you grew up in and apart from what your parents own and stuff like that, is your faith a legitimate thing? Do you actually believe that there is coming a time when you're going to be in the presence of God Almighty? Because if there is, if this thing is real and he is a legitimate thing, then there's a point in time where you need to jump off the fence and you need to say, okay, I'm either going all in with him or I'm going all in with the world. And some of you guys are in the middle of this incredible decision right now because your friends over here at school and the world and everything that is going one direction over here, and you're being pulled over here and you're going, oh my gosh, which way do I need to go? Can I just be real? Like, this is exactly my personal story here. 16 years old, was on top of that fence, and it was there at Enchanted Rock during this whole repelling thing that God got a hold of my affections and said, are you all in or are you not? Because faith is the assurance of things hoped for and conviction about things that are unseen. It's not just, okay, I'm pretty sure about this, okay? God is my God in these areas over here, but he's not the God of my sexuality. He's not the God of how I think. He's not the God of how I pursue life or pursue friendships or pursue relationships or pursue anything else. He's either God or he's not. And students, some of you guys are right here in the middle of this place where you're sitting here going, okay, is he God or is he not? Are you willing to jump, or are you going to be trying to hold on to this rope and you're just going to be banging into the side of this mountain over and over again? Some of you guys are right there. And again, adults, I'd say the exact same thing. Some of you may have been holding on to your spouse's faith for a long time. You may be coming here and kind of just saying, you know what, she's really the religious one in the family. He's kind of the religious one who's got this faith, and I kind of come and pay attention a little bit. And some of you have been holding on to a spouse's faith, or maybe it was your parents' faith or something like that, and there's coming a time when you need to sit there and say, okay, am I going to live my life by faith? What am I actually going all in on? When God speaks to Noah, it doesn't matter how absurd it looks. It doesn't matter that he is the only person left that is still remaining faithful to God. God is God. God is God. He knows who he is. There's a legitimate, realistic time coming in the future when he is going to be in the presence of God, and that is the only thing that makes sense for how to live right now. Noah's a person that jumped. Abraham's the exact same way. Verse 8, God calls him and tells him to go to a place. He doesn't know where he's going, right? God calls him and he says, leave your home. Abraham packs up his entire family. He packs up all of his belongings, and he says, God is leading us to a land. We don't know where he's going. But if God says pick up and go, I'm going to pick up and go. And for some of you, again, that is exactly what God is doing in your heart and in your mind. He is calling you to go. You may not know where that is, but if God calls you to go, much like Abraham, then we need to be willing to go. If God has called us to go into all the world, making disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, then we need to all seriously wrestle with this question. Okay, God, where are you leading me to go and do that? Maybe it is here in Dallas, and maybe it is there in your office place. Maybe it's even there on your street with your neighbors or something like that. But maybe it's halfway around the world. But for some of you, when God calls, what we see in Abraham is this faith that says, God, even if it doesn't make any sense, when you are calling and when you are telling me to go, I am willing to go no matter what. No matter what, I'm willing to jump. And that's what we're seeing here in the life of Abraham. And we could keep going through the entire chapter. Verse 11, Sarah does the exact same thing. She jumps. Guys, it says that God promised her a baby. She waits over 25 years for this child. We recognize that Sarah was not like 5 when she was given this promise, right? Like she was really, really old when this promise was given. And she had to wait 25 years to see this come to fruition. I'm going to be really, really careful here because Sarah received a specific promise from God that she was going to have an heir. And that may not necessarily be our specific promise here, but here it is. When God speaks, do you take him at his word? Which brings up another little point here and stuff. How can you be a person of faith if you don't know his word? Right? When God speaks, are you willing to live by faith? Are you willing to jump? None of this makes any sense unless you believe that he exists and that he's a rewarder of those who earnestly seek him. Why would you do that? Why does someone build an ark when it doesn't make sense? Why does someone take his whole entire family and go where he does not know where God is leading? It's found here in verse 6. Because you know that he exists and you know that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. This is the assurance that they have. This is the conviction that they have that God exists and that he is a rewarder of those who earnestly seek him. In other words, for Abel and for Enoch and for Noah and for Abraham and for Sarah and for Jacob and for Isaac and for Joshua and for everybody else that's here in this passage, everyone else who has succeeded by faith, God is not this lucky rabbit's foot that they're holding on to, or he's not this fairy tale that he tells his kids at night just so that they can sleep a little bit better. He is actually the Prince of Peace and the King of Kings. He is actually the one who spoke the world into existence. He is actually the one who promises to return again. And when they are thinking about those promises, they are very well aware of the fact that he is faithful to those promises, and they are expecting to see him again one day. He is not just something that they are telling stories about before they go to bed. They're looking around and they're going, okay, all of creation did not just happen by chance. They're sitting there going, there is evidence for design. There are his fingerprints all over this thing. He actually exists. I love how Francis Collins talks about this. Francis Collins is one of the leading scientists in the world. He's head of the Human Genome Project. Here's what he says about this. He's kind of looking at the fingerprints of God all around the world, and here's what he says. He says, when you look from the perspective of a scientist at the universe, it looks as if it knew we were coming. There are 15 constants, the gravitational constant, various constants about the strong and weak nuclear force, etc., that have precise values. If any one of those constants were off by even one part in a million, or in some cases by one part in a million million, then the whole universe could not have actually come to the point where we see it today. Matter would not have been able to coalesce. There would have been no galaxy, stars, planets, or people. I mean, church, what do we do with this, right? There's evidence for design, and there's evidence for God's fingerprints all over the place. The world is incredibly complex. Complexity always points to design. We were looking around here, and we recognized that he exists. This is not just an accident. This is not just happening by chance. Years ago, I was doing a wedding for a friend on top of Keystone Mountain in Colorado. And I was riding the gondola on the way up to this wedding, and I looked over to the side. On the side of this mountain, somebody had written on the side of the mountain. They carved it in the snow and said, I love you, Julie. Will you marry me? Right? I'm just kind of looking over. I was like, it was a proposal. I was like, oh, that's kind of sweet. And of course, I looked at that, and of course, two things immediately pop in your mind. And you look at that, and you're going, oh, my gosh. Well, number one, I feel sorry for every other Julie riding the gondola up there today, especially the one who's, like, up there with her boyfriend and stuff, right? Like, that would be horrible. Number two, I thought, wow, that was very, very thoughtful that some person took the initiative to go and to carve that into the side of the mountain in order to propose to his girlfriend. I didn't sit there and think, oh my gosh, what an unbelievable random chance that the snow happened to fall in such a way that it just formed all these perfectly articulated letters. And these letters just happened to line up side by side to create these words, and these words came together to create this complex sentence. It happens to be in English, and it happens to correspond with the exact time that this person comes by and proposes to his girlfriend at the same time. It makes no sense, right? Complexity always points to design. We are seeing evidence of his design and his handiwork all around the world. And these believers are looking at that, and they're going, okay, I am fully convinced. It is the assurance of things hoped for. It is a conviction about things that are unseen. I'm sitting there, and I'm looking around the world going, he exists. But not just in an absent and in a distant way. Like, what do we do with the resurrection? How do we explain the resurrection? All of the evidence around the life of Christ, everything that he came to do, everything that happened afterwards, those 3 days after his life and death, how do you explain these things? All right, there are a number of things we've talked about here in the past. There are a number of things that scholars from all faiths agree upon that are true about the life of Christ. They're looking at his life, and everybody agrees that Jesus was a historical man who lived a virtuous life during the time of Tiberius Caesar. They're looking at his life, and everyone agrees that he was a miracle worker and who accomplished amazing things that people could not explain naturally. Okay, if you saw some of the things that Jesus did, like, how do you explain some of these things? It doesn't happen every day. He had a brother named James who wasn't a follower of Jesus until after the resurrection. Think about that one for a second. What would it take for you to convince your brother or sister that you were the Messiah? How do you explain this? James was not a believer during his life. 3 days after his crucifixion, James goes to the grave proclaiming that Jesus is alive and the King of all kings and Lord of all lords, his brother, okay? Hundreds who knew him and followed him claimed that he was a Messiah, so it wasn't an isolated incident. It wasn't like, hey, I had this one little vision over here. No, no, no. 500 eyewitnesses coming around spreading this message that Jesus was alive. People, all faiths are recognizing that this is what historically actually happened, people giving this testimony. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate on the eve of the Jewish Passover because he claimed to be the Messiah. Okay, so none of this whole thing about, well, Jesus never said he was the Son of God. He died because he was claiming he was the Son of God, right? Darkness fell over the earth. That's a nice coincidence. An earthquake occurred roughly at noon, exactly as he passed away. Interesting coincidence. His disciples were devastated and depressed when he was crucified. So they're not plotting about how to spread this religion that's going to capture the affections of the entire world. They are down and depressed when Jesus is dead upon the cross. Jesus was buried in a tomb by an unbelieving Jew. Again, this is not his posse over here who's got this plot in place. This is an unbelieving Jew giving him his tomb. Roman guards protected that grave. These are trained soldiers, people who know how to fight and know how to ward off a coup, okay? 3 days after the crucifixion, Jesus' disciples do a complete 180. They are down and depressed. 3 days later, they have all the hope and anticipation in the world. They're ready to go take the world by storm, claiming that Jesus is alive. Okay, massive 180. They claim that he rose from the dead. The common day of worship moved from Saturday to Sunday in recognition of the resurrection. They spent the rest of their lives spreading that message, and every single one of the apostles and disciples ended up dying for that message. You remember when Watergate came out? Probably not. Maybe some of you do. When Watergate came out, trained military men, soldiers, generals, people who are trained with torture, they know how to endure torture. They all cracked under the weight of what they were supposed to testify. They would not go to the grave testifying for something that they knew was a lie. All of these fishermen, lay people, tax collectors, his followers, every single one of them went to the grave claiming that he was alive and that he was the Messiah, the Prince of Peace, and the King of Kings. Nearly 500 people gave testimony to that exact same story after his resurrection. Church, what do we do with all this? Like, these are commonly held, this is across religious boundaries, and scholars of all faith are recognizing that these facts, these things are true. What do we do with all of that? There's complexity all around the world. There's evidence for the resurrection. It is a complete confidence in someone or something. This isn't just a blind faith or some fairy tale stories that we're telling our kids at night. There is things that demand a verdict here, as Josh McDowell might say. There are things that we are looking here that you need to come up with an explanation for. And what we're seeing here in these heroes of the faith are people are looking upon God and they're saying, you know what, I'm holding a royal flush in my hands and I'm willing to go all in by faith with him. Church, he exists, and they're sitting there going, you know what, if this thing is real, if there really is an eternity where I'm going to come before him, and I'm going to stare him face to face, I'm going to look at him, and this whole thing is real, and this is not all that there is, that I'm going to be with him in eternity, then what else makes sense except to live for him right now? And of course, he continues on in verse 6, and he says, not only do they know that he exists, but they recognize that he is generous, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So not only does he exist, not only is he far and distant and removed from where we are, but he's generous, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. I love this. Check it out in verse 13, one of the most encouraging verses you'll ever read. All of these died in faith without receiving the promises. That was encouraging, wasn't it? Okay, I thought that he just said that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. All of these died in faith without receiving the promises. want us to notice, we're going to keep going here in verse 13. I want you to notice how they viewed reward at that time. All of these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them, meaning the promises and the rewards, and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. So how did they view rewards? From a distance, right? They viewed this concept of rewards from a distance. They were far away, and so that meaning that they didn't look for the immediacy of these rewards all the time. They knew that there was eternal rewards that were coming. There's this thing that Scripture talks about where God promises eternal rewards, and we don't know exactly what that looks like, and it's complex, and we're kind of looking at these things going, okay, I'm not even really motivated by rewards. Here's what I would say about that. If the God who created you, who numbered the hairs upon your head, the God who knows how you are most satisfied and most delighted, if the God who did all of those things, if he knows you that intimately and he promises to bring you reward by walking with faith, whatever that whole thing looks like in there, I promise you it is something that you want to hold on to. Like, I want that guy on my Christmas lottery list. I want him buying gifts for me, right? And he promises to bring these rewards. And so what we're seeing here in these early believers is that they are looking at the concept of rewards from a distance. Here's what it says here. It says, verses 32, what more shall I say? There's absolutely reward now. So it's not just eternal and it's not just far away, but there is reward now. Verse 32, check this out. What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith they conquered kingdoms. They performed acts of righteousness. They obtained promises, meaning there was immediate reward. There was something going on right here. They're obtaining promises. They shut the mouths of lions. They quenched the power of fire. They escaped the edge of the sword. From weakness were made strong. They became mighty in war and put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. In other words, there is absolutely reward now. But that's not the only thing that they experienced. It says, but others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, and they were sawn in two, and they were tempted, and they were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not even worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all of these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Why? Here it is. Because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. You know what he just said there? He said, yeah, sometimes there is reward now. Like, guys, church, there is an incredible reward for walking by faith. These people, they were able to conquer kingdoms. They were able to perform acts of righteousness. They obtained promises. They saw the mouths of lions shut. There was immediate reward many, many times that happens right now. Sometimes there's reward now, sometimes that reward is coming much, much later, and you need to trust that these eternal rewards, whatever those may be that God speaks of, are coming in the future. And then sometimes what he's saying right here is that the reward is not specifically about you. Sometimes the reward that is to come is about the people that are coming after you. Maybe it's your children, maybe it's the next generation. That's exactly what he says right here, because God had provided something better for us. They did not receive what was promised. Why? Because God had provided something for us. That was Abraham's testimony. Abraham's faithfulness, he did not get to enter into the promised land. Moses and his faithfulness, walking by faith, everything that God used him to do, he did not get to walk into the promised land. Their lives, their whole entire lives of faithfulness was set up so that the generations after them would be able to experience the blessing of their faithfulness. Church, would you be okay if your faithfulness now never comes back to you right now, but maybe your children or your children's children or the generation coming after you gets to benefit from everything that you're investing in right now? Where's our hope for us as a church? I want to end with this one. Randy Alcorn, in his book, The Treasure Principle, he tells this story that fell in love with. It's the testimony of William Borden. He is the heir to the Borden Empire. His grave is in Cairo, Egypt. And if you go over there today, it's kind of this hidden thing. It's not a big deal. It's very overgrown and grassy. Not a whole lot of people would even know about it today, except that the story and his testimony has been told time and time again. But The grave is William Borden. He's the heir of the Borden Milk Company. And back in 1909, he graduated from Yale University. And of course, you can imagine upon graduation, as heir to the Borden Empire, you've got your entire future lined up. He's already got millions in his bank account. He's got security for the rest of his life. He's got power. He's got prestige. He's got luxury. He's got everything that many people would give their entire lives for. Problem is, when he was in high school, he took a trip around the world, and God got a hold of his affections. And he began seeing what God was doing and not doing all around the world. And during that trip, God gave him a burden and a desire to give his entire life to the mission field. And so he comes back from that trip, and he tells his parents as a high schooler, and he says, I'm not going to be inheriting this company upon graduation. I'm giving my entire life to spread the gospel amongst the Muslims, specifically in China, is where he felt like he was calling. And, of course, they were disappointed. Nobody understood his decision. They didn't understand why someone would give up millions and millions and millions of dollars in security to go and hit the mission field. So, of course, graduation comes, and it's time for him to go out and to go hit the mission field and everything. And he's on his way to China. And on the way to China, he stops in Cairo, Egypt, so that he can spend 4 months learning Arabic so that he can have a more effective witness with the Muslims that he would be reaching. While he was there in Cairo, Egypt, he contracted meningitis and died within the 4 months that he was there. Just before he passed away, one of his friends and the people that was hitting the mission field with him had a conversation with him. It wasn't much of a conversation. He wasn't talking very much then. But he asked him, he said, looking back at everything that he'd given up and passed up, he said, do you regret anything that you've decided to do? I mean, you gave up the entire Borden Empire to come over here, and you didn't even get to go and to share the gospel with Muslims in China. Do you regret it? And Borden just looked at him, and he pointed him to the inside of his Bible. The guy pulls out of his Bible, and here's what he had written on the inside of his Bible. When he was in high school and during the time of that trip, he wrote on the inside of his Bible, no reservations, no reserves, meaning I'm going to be giving away my entire life, and I'm not going to be keeping anything in my reserves. I'm giving it all out for the kingdom. When he got to graduation, on that graduation day, he wrote next to that, he said, no retreat, meaning he's not going back no matter what happens. When he first contracted meningitis, he wrote, no regrets. No reserves, no retreat, and no regrets. If you go to his tombstone today in Cairo, Egypt, some of his friends that were there, they wrote a plaque and a brief description of his life, and here's what his companions had to say about him. He wrote this. A man in Christ, he arose and forsook all and followed him. Kindly affectioned with brotherly love, fervent in spirit serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, instant in prayer, communicating to the necessity of saints in honor, preferring other people. Here it is. Apart from faith in Jesus Christ, there is no explanation for such a life. And church, that would be my challenge to you. Could that be said of you? Could that be said of me? It's the question I've been wrestling with all week long as I've been looking at this chapter. Could that be said of me? Apart from faith in Jesus Christ, there can be no explanation for such a life. I'm fully convinced that God has been speaking and doing a work in some of your lives, and he's been pushing some of you out the door. He's been pushing some of you to get a bigger global picture of what he's doing all around the world, and you're sitting there, and there's this discomfort in your soul, and you're going, okay, Dallas is wonderful, and Dallas is great, but God is doing something different inside of me, and he's giving you a burden for the lost all around the world. And much like Abraham, when God says go, you need to get up and go. And for some of you, it's something like an Abel thing where you've been blessed with all kinds of things. God has given you an empire. One of the beautiful things about Borden is even when he was in high school, he was giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars to the mission field while he was in high school. He refused to buy himself a car. Like, what high schooler refuses to buy a car? That doesn't make any sense. He refused to buy all these different things that he could have had, no one else had, and he was giving it away to the mission field. And for some of you, God has been urging you, and he's been making you get a big view of what he has given to you. And by faith, you need to say, I'm going to be giving him my first, and I'm going to be giving him my best. And for some of you, you're looking around at the world that you're living in, and you're going, you know what? I am alone. There is no one else here that is walking by faith. Some of you students that are at school, that is exactly your world right now. You're looking around going, who walks by faith anymore? Like, seriously, who does this? And like Noah, you need to say, no matter how absurd it may look, and no matter how crazy it is that God is asking me to do this thing, I'm all in. I'm going all in with him. That is what faith is. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and a conviction about things unseen. Church, may it be said of us, and may it be true of us, that apart from faith in Jesus Christ, there could be no explanation for such a life.